Hello and welcome back to the Economics Review. Our guest today is the chairman of the Department of Economics at Harvard University, where he has taught microeconomic theory and urban and public economics since 1992. Holding a PhD in economics from the University of Chicago, his work has focused on the determinants of city growth and the role of cities as centers of idea transmission. It is my great pleasure to welcome to the show one of the great urban economists of our time, Dr. Edward Glaser. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Firstly, I'd like to ask you to tell us a bit about yourself and your research for our audience who may not be familiar.
I'm an economist who studies cities, which is what I've done for my entire adult life. Much of this work began on the roles of cities as engines of growth. In a sense, this idea was in the air at the University of Chicago when I was there in the 1980s. And so if I sort of take you back to the new growth theory and Paul Romer and Bob Lucas in those years, there was this recognition that in order to square economic competition with constantly growing economies, there needed to be some source of increasing returns, something that breaks the fact that you have this sort of classic solo growth model, this thing that, without exogenous increase in technological change, growth comes to a screeching halt. But with increasing returns, this doesn't need to be the case. But those increasing returns, to be compatible with perfect competition, they need to come in the form of externalities, things that are not, internalized by ordinary firms, positive effects that are just spewed out into the air. Paul Romer called this knowledge, the benefits of technological change that are not, in fact, accrued by firms themselves, but are enjoyed by people outside. Bob Lucas saw this in the form of human capital externalities, which then led Bob in the sort of very last section to his classic On the Mechanics of Economic Development, which then led him to the view that cities perhaps are important, led him back to Jane Jacobs, who had written in The Economy of Cities then 20 years earlier about the role of cities as places where old ideas become combined to create new ideas. It led all of us back to what Alfred Marshall talked about when he described that in dense clusters, the mysteries of the trade become no mystery, but are, as it were, in the air. That's Alfred Marshall, the great 19th century English economist. And that really set me off on working on my work on cities. And so my early work was on the growth of cities. It was documenting that urban growth was related to having lots of industrial diversity and having lots of little firms and having an abundance of human capital. And then I moved on from there to what happens when people are cut off from the human capital of cities. When is there segregation? When are there ghettos? And how problematic were they for cities? I then moved on to cities and crime, trying to understand the physical roots of urban change, right? So as economists, we should never forget that the real city is not the skyline. The real city is the flesh and blood, the humanity that's empowered by that skyline. But of course, the skyline still makes a difference. Cities can only grow in terms of population as quickly as they can add structures to house that growth. And when cities start to decline, often the population remains even when the economic productivity has ebbed because the structures remain in place. And so the first thing that happens when a city declines is that prices decline rather than population going down. And that's how we can understand phenomena like the city of Detroit, which has declined more or less steadily every decade for the last 70 years as housing has increasingly fallen into disuse. And then over the past 10 years, I've been more focused on the cities in the developing world, where it seems as if, the problems are particularly dire, but the upside is also tremendous. So those are that's sort of a broad overview of what I do.
Okay, so Dr. Glaser, you've been a strong proponent of urbanization, arguing that cities foster idea transmission and lead to increases in income, social mobility, economic growth, and so on. So over the past several decades, humanity has seen large-scale urbanization, with the majority of the world population now living in cities. However, this phenomenon has looked quite a bit different in developed nations, with the infrastructure to adequately house and provide food and water and transportation for its inhabitants, compared to poorer nations in which life for most has remained brutal and inhumane. So Dr. Glaser, I wanted to ask you whether Western-style urbanization is just as beneficial in the developing world and how it differs from urbanization as we've seen it in the United States.
So it's all countries have slightly different aspects to their urbanization patterns. I would say the most striking difference between urbanization in the developing world and Western urbanization in the 19th and early 20th century is that it's occurring at much lower levels of income. So if you think about the United States, U.S. didn't become 50% urbanized until 1920, when our per capita income in modern dollars somewhere around $9,000. We started seeing poor world urbanization at much lower levels of income in 1960, when Mexico became 50% urban at a per capita income, I don't know, maybe $4,000. Then we saw Brazil become 50% urban in 1964, per capita income probably a little less than $3,000. And now we see, you know, great cities rise, like Kinshasa, in places that have per capita incomes that are below $1,000. What that inevitably means that these cities are still have to face the challenges that always come with urbanization, the traffic congestion, the contagious disease, the high housing costs, the crime. And yet they have to face those, you know, negative consequences of urbanization with far fewer resources than Western economies had. Luckily, they do have different forms of technology that can make things helpful. So, you know, they may be too poor to afford sewers, but at the very least, they have access to antibiotics. But it's a different ballgame, in part because the levels of income are so much lower. That's happening, at least in part, because historically, countries needed to be rich before they urbanized because they had to have very significant agricultural surpluses to feed their urban populations. And that meant that you were rich in a pre-modern world. Today, agricultural productivity is far more advanced. You know, Mexico's move to being 50% urban followed the Green Revolution of the 1950s. And moreover, it's certainly possible food from the West. You know, Port-au-Prince doesn't need to be fed by Haitian farmers. It can be fed with rice shipped out of New Orleans.
Okay. And so how does...
If you want to follow, I mean, you should feel free to ask a follow-up on that if you want.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask whether this sort of urbanization still has the same economic advantages in countries with far fewer resources.
Oh, I think if anything, it's likely to have even more advantages. I know of no pathway out of poverty into prosperity that does not run through city streets. The connection between urban density and earnings in India and Brazil is stronger than in the US. Cities are the conduits across cultures, across continents, and consequently, they're the place in which new ideas and new investment works its way into developing world cities.
Okay, so now I wanted to get your take on a few issues facing cities in the United States, starting with affordable housing, especially in California, where the average price of homes is several times the average income, and where homelessness is at almost third world rates. The government has experimented with several policies, many of which have only worsened the issue, like rent control. So, Dr. Glaser, I wanted to ask you what the California government should be doing to alleviate the homelessness crisis and bring the price of housing down.
So I see these two crises as being linked, but not entirely the same thing. In general, there's no repealing the laws of supply and demand. And if you're going to have a place that is extremely attractive, as coastal California is, both in terms of its climate and in terms of its economies, and if you're going to be very restrictive in terms of the amount of housing that you're going to allow to be built, then it's going to end up being expensive. And, you know, in the 1960s, California remained affordable because it was something of a builder's paradise. People could, you know, developers could put up massive amounts of, you know, ranch style homes in the suburbs of LA, you know, ad infinitum. Over the past 50 years, restrictions have gone up and it's become harder and harder to build. I don't think there's any possible way to get towards a more affordable California without making it much easier to build, without allowing density levels to increase quite substantially. Now, there's no problem in terms of adding density in California from a straight housing perspective, in the sense that, you know, Los Angeles County just isn't that dense by any sort of reasonable urban standards. And it certainly would be quite possible to add in lots of new apartments without, you know, damaging the natural landscape or anything like that. There is a slight challenge with densifying LA in that Los Angelinos at this point in time overwhelmingly drive, and California's highways, even if we embraced congestion pricing as we should, that induces drivers to internalize the social costs of their driving, even if we do embrace congestion pricing, it's just hard to imagine that California's roads could handle the kind of driving that tons of extra development would create. The only really natural solution for that is to do more with public transportation, to do more with sort of, you know, old style development in the urban core of Los Angeles. San Francisco, in fact, if anything, is easier. The BART system is fairly functional, and it's, you know, easier to imagine, San Francisco adding more densification. I mean, lots of greater San Francisco is incredibly low density. And, you know, there's just no reason why America's most productive metropolitan area shouldn't allow a lot more building than it does. I don't believe that, you know, any conceivable amount of building will ever make California cheap or ever make it possible for the poorest people to afford living in these areas. And so I tend to think that, homelessness is likely to continue to be an issue. It's particularly an issue in California, of course, because the climate is mild. And consequently, people select to live in California if they don't have a home, because it's much less unpleasant than living in Minneapolis in the winter if you don't have a home. So I don't have a clear right answer for homelessness in California that doesn't involve, you know, very intensive type of programs. And I'm just not sure I know of a sensible economics fix for this.
Yeah. And that's another issue you touched on there that I wanted to ask you about with regards to public transportation. So this is something that I think the United States has really struggled with in developing its public transportation infrastructure. Whereas in Europe, most cities have exceptional public transportation systems. So why this disparity between the two continents?
There are a couple of reasons for it. One part is just America was much richer during the middle decades of the 20th century when cars came online. And so we just embraced automobiles, really, we had the means to do so. Secondly, because we had so much of America that was not built up in the post-war period, we were able to basically rebuild our cities around the automobile. That would be much harder to do in a urban system that's really quite mature, like Germany or France. And so we left older cities, which had, quite well built up public transit systems. Those public transit systems were left to decay, partially because, wealthier urbanites switched to driving. And we just moved to cities like Phoenix or Las Vegas, which are basically entirely built around the car, in part because the average commute by car is just a lot faster than the average commute by public transportation. I mean, my estimates were always that, every public transit trip involved a fixed time cost of between 15 and 20 minutes of walking to the subway stop, waiting for the subway to arrive, and then walking from wherever the subway would drop you off. That needs to be compared against an average car commute of 24 minutes. So it's just the speed of the car makes it incredibly attractive. Plus, of course, we've engaged in large-scale federal subsidies of automobiles by building the interstate highway system and not funding its maintenance with gas taxes, but rather using general tax revenues to fund the highway system. It's not clear what the right path is going forward on this, other than reducing our subsidies of a carbon intensive lifestyle, which seems sort of mad in the mid 21st century. I would say one other thing on public transportation, which is that there's an old joke that 40 years of transportation economics at Harvard can be boiled down to four words: bus good, train bad. And I think that's more true than ever, particularly in our sort of post-pandemic world, where we really recognize the value of flexibility. But buses are just much cheaper. They're much more flexible. They use infrastructure that can be shared with cars or not shared with cars, right? And there's not a lot that you can do with a train in a city that you can't do on a bus with a dedicated lane. Buses become even more attractive when we think about the possibility of having autonomous electric buses. So I think we really should be thinking about doing more with buses as we think about densifying areas that had been sort of entirely oriented towards the car.
Yeah, and so the next thing I wanted to ask you about, just building off of that, is the population density, which maximizes the benefits of urbanization. So as more and more people have moved to cities all over the world, population density in places like Manila in the Philippines and Hong Kong has risen to tens of thousands of people per square mile, leading to lawless slums and often inhumane living conditions. So whilst virtually all available indicators show that the benefits of urbanization far outweigh the costs, I wanted to get a sense of how dense a population can get before it becomes insanitary and impossible to effectively police.
So I don't think there is any particular rule on this. And it all depends very much on the quality of government. I mean, if you gave me if you told me that it was the government of Singapore that was going to be running this, I think the government of Singapore could basically handle, which I think of the government of Singapore as basically being the most functional government in the world in lots of ways. But part of the rise of poor world urbanism is you have these highly dense areas and governments that are far less capable than that of Singapore. And, you know, even historically, when you saw megacities prior to, let's say, 1800, they were always the capital of empires. Right. They were Rome 2000 years ago. They were Baghdad during the height of the Abbasid Caliphate. They were the various capitals of China over the centuries. They were Tokyo under the Tokugawa shoguns. Right. These were, the capitals of basically the most competent governments of their age. That's how they got to be empires. They were the most competent governments. And so consequently, they were able to handle their urban problems much more effectively, sometimes not by using modern technology. But, Julius Caesar just cleared the streets of Rome of wheeled transport for the first 8 hours or so of every day to try and alleviate traffic congestion. Good luck handling that in most developing world slums today. People would just ignore you and you wouldn't be able to enforce it without killing people. So it is a big challenge. I don't think that the right answer is to look at them and say, boy, we just want to, stop people from coming to these areas. I think what we want to do is to fight to make the slums of the developing world more livable, which I think is not putting a brake on urbanization, but on confronting these problems, be they, trying to deal with clean water in developing world cities, which I think is the most important function of city government, or dealing with traffic congestion, dealing with crime.
Okay, yeah. So next, I wanted to talk to you about the limits to city growth in terms of absolute population this time instead of density, especially as we've seen it in China. So, for example, the Pearl River Delta containing Hong Kong, Macau, Shenzhen, which is home to 120 million people, are slowly merging together to form one giant megacity. A similar phenomenon has occurred in the Yangtze Delta area around Shanghai, with several urban centers spreading outwards and merging together to form one large city of over 200 million people. So with many people spending over 6 hours a day commuting to and from work, it seems that many of the economic advantages of urbanization are lost, although China is still investing heavily in developing and connecting such massive cities together. So, Dr. Glaser, I wanted to get your opinion on this sort of urbanization like we're seeing in China and whether it's likely to be the way of the future.
This type of sort of megalopolis development, and anytime you see is an exceptional phenomenon. It really reflects, just the extraordinary advantages that come with urban density in China. I mean, China is sort of an amazing place because if you go to Shenzhen, right, technopolis, it's right near to Hong Kong, you feel like you are in some sense, like the technological hub of the world, right? A place that is as sophisticated as any place else, a place that is crammed full of fancy cars and high-end malls. And then you go 200 miles away and you feel like you're confronting old-style Chinese rural poverty. Okay. And that gulf is incredible. And that gulf is why people are willing to put up with sort of anything to be part of the sort of pulsing center of one of these great cities. It's hard to imagine, anything similar to this ever evolving in Europe or the UK. It's just too easy to create something that is, a slightly less productive facsimile somewhere else. Right. I mean, the Silicon Valley is expensive. People are looking for a different type of government. And so Austin, Texas grows. you know, London is too expensive. People move to Birmingham and Manchester. I mean, there's competition among these cities, and there's competition in terms of quality of life that just makes this kind of thing less likely to happen in most normal places. You do see the same level of huge commutes in places like Sao Paulo, for example, which also has this phenomenon of being a very productive metropolitan area in the heart of a country which still has a great deal of poverty. But it's not quite as extreme as just the sheer, you know, the sheer size of a greater Shanghai. The other thing to remember, of course, is that China is just a very, very large country. And so if you think about these cities as a share of total country population, they're actually much smaller than in many other places.
Yep, man. So, I mean, I wanted to think about, like, whether this is possible in the United States. So, for example, if sometime in the next 100, 150 years, Boston, Philadelphia, New York, Washington, D.C. all keep on spreading further and further and eventually all connect into one giant contiguous city. Do you think that's something that's possible? Is that something that we are likely to see, or would people just start flocking out of the cities before that would be possible?
In some sense, I would like to see more of it, but it's not going to happen because local zoning rules are going to prevent it. I mean, you don't have to get very far out of Boston to be in the midst of the woods because local land use regulations make sure that that's so. It's sort of, you know, the U.S. equivalent of the Greenbelt that surrounds London and that stops London from being sort of a continuous urban thing. So I think these rules make it difficult to sort of imagine a constant city. But are these, you know, is the Boston to New York to Washington, D.C. corridor tightly connected? Is it in some sense a megalopolis even now? Yes, it is. It's a place which has very close linkages, and it's very easy to get around between the different parts of this this sort of large urban connected area. But I don't expect sort of what's intrinsic in your vision is you really are going to imagine people living an hour south of Philadelphia, commuting to Boston on a regular basis, or even commuting to New York. I think that's pretty unlikely.
Okay. So now I wanted to talk to you about the changes that we've seen throughout the course of the pandemic and what it means for the study of urban economics. So with more and more jobs that can now be done entirely from home, workers have the option to seek jobs from around the country in a much larger job market, and employers have access to a much broader pool of prospective employees. So Dr. Glaser, I wanted to ask you the degree to which the importance of urbanization has been undermined by the pandemic and whether the economic advantages of cities still hold as true as they did before.
I think so. You know, there is a sense in which, you know, we have become more comfortable connecting electronically. And that's a good thing, not a bad thing. I mean, more options for connection are preferred to less. But this is not the first time we've, you know, considered whether or not electronic interactions would make face-to-face interactions and the cities that enable those face-to-face interactions obsolete. You know, 40 years ago, the futurist Alvin Toffler was contemplating a world of electronic cottages where we would all just dial it in and our cities would be full of empty forests of skyscrapers. For 40 years, that vision proved completely wrong, right? And I argued, you know, when I first wrote about this almost 30 years ago, that what he was missing was the fact that, you know, these technologies were creating a more interactive world. They were creating a world in which being, you know, being smart was more valuable than ever. Being connected was more valuable than ever. I mean, we are a social species that gets smart by being around other smart people. That's what cities do. And so even though we can connect more electronically, we want to connect more physically because we want those sort of ultra-rich interactions that come from face-to-face contact. It's, you know, the more complex an idea is, the easier it is for that idea to get lost in translation, and the more valuable it is to have synchronous communication that really makes this stuff work. So we've gone through another one of these bouts with thinking that the future is likely to be electronic. I think there may well be some interactions that are displaced by Zoom. I for one, certainly hope to have a lot fewer trips to Chicago or other cities just to have a 45-minute meeting there.
Yeah.
The sounds of the city behind me. But I don't think that means that we're going to stop coming into the office, at least most of the time.
Okay. And finally, I wanted to ask you about population growth and declining birth rates. So global average fertility rates have dropped by half in the last 50 years during the same time in which urbanization has increased exponentially, the two variables being undoubtedly correlated. So countries across Europe and Asia have dangerously low fertility rates that could cause severe issues in the next few decades. So Dr. Glaser, I wanted to ask you what government should be doing to remedy this situation and whether we'll see the world population hit a maximum anytime soon.
You know, it's funny. This was one of the last questions that Gary Becker was sort of obsessed with. And I remember spending time with Gary thinking about it. Gary Becker is sort of one of the greatest of all Chicago school economists and a mentor of mine. I don't know when we're going to reach our maximum anytime soon. I would guess it's probably in your lifetime and not in mine if I had to. But what I think governments need to be doing is allowing the places that have too many people to export people to the places that have too few people. We certainly don't have a problem of falling populations yet globally. And, you know, the places that have birth rates that are below replacement rate could do a marvelous thing for the world and for themselves by allowing migrants from poor countries. I mean, you know, there's just a lot to like about enabling people to move to areas in which, you know, they can find opportunity. And there's a lot to like about being in countries that open their arms to new immigrants and, you know, fulfill the promise that's etched into the Statue of Liberty. So I think that to me is the most natural public policy response. But you're certainly right that, you know, for really any job other than sort of subsistence agriculture makes sort of mass fertility harder, right? I mean, the beauty of sort of traditional farming is you just, you know, let the kids play in the farm and, you know, they're not really much of a bother. And so you can have lots of kids and it's all good. As soon as you have collaborative production in sort of a fixed area that's going to be away from your kids, that becomes a lot harder. And for that reason, cities have always been negatively associated with fertility rates. Although, interestingly, the cities in the developing world today have much higher fertility rates and are much more likely to be, you know, to grow by fertility than any of the Western cities were. And that's another difference between developing world urbanization and the urbanization of the West. But, you know, I would expect, as I said, probably we'll reach a global maximum sometime in your lifetime, but not in mine.
Well, those are all the questions that I have for you today. It's been an absolute honor speaking with you. So thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for your great questions.
Dr. Glaser's latest book, Survival of the City, Living and Thriving in an Age of Isolation, is available on Amazon and truly phenomenal. So I highly recommend you go check that out. Thank you, everyone, for listening to the Economics Review. And as always, we'll be back soon with the latest.